3526-4000. Please join listeners like you in helping to ensure that the independent voice of KPFT will be preserved for generations to come. Name KPFT as a beneficiary in your will today. This is KPFT Houston.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds.
Unmistakable beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And that means it's 8 p.m. on a Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them right here on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. Well, I'm your host tonight, Eric Heen, along with co-host Paul Topekian. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for the invite.
You betcha. And Paul and I are backed up by the talented team of Dr. Sank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, as well as Greg Audell, and our engineer, the incomparable Tatiana Gago. And we have two guest hosts, Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman, and we have our intern tonight is Justin O'Neill. And here we place the spotlight on guests who'll take us on magical journeys before landing us safely back into the present. Well, tonight we're going to hear stories about the dangers of cultural misunderstandings, like when you're in a foreign land, and if you don't know the local customs and ways of doing things, you can get in a lot of trouble, as well as cause problems for other people. So our guest storyteller tonight, Joe Lurie, is an expert on sorting out these cultural misunderstandings. His stories will show the importance of looking past our ethnocentrism and to see other cultures with an objective eye. Paul, what do we know about Joe Lurie?
Eric, for 20 years, Joe Lurie was the executive director of UC Berkeley's International House, a campus program center with over 500 residents from 80 countries. Joe is now a career coach for immigrants and a cross-cultural communications trainer for numerous organizations. He's presented at Google, American Express, LinkedIn, and the World Affairs Council. He's the author of the book, Perceptions and Deception, A Mind-Opening Journey Across Cultures, which you can get at Joe's website, which is perceptionanddeception.com, all one word. And his writings have appeared in Harper's Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, and his work has been featured on NPR, PBS, and most recently on C-SPAN's Book TV. A connection that I don't know Joe had to all of us sitting here on the radio is that I believe Joe spent a part of his career working at AFS USA, which is an exchange program here. And we've, on the radio here, hosted AFS exchange students twice telling stories about being strangers in a strange land. So there's a nice tie there, Joe.
Well, it's an honor to join you, and yes, indeed, I spent a couple of years working at AFS, and some of the most powerful experiences, transformative experiences I witnessed were students who spent an immersion year abroad learning a language in ways they never imagined.
Mm-hmm.
So, an honor to join you, happy to tell you some stories, and hope your audience enjoys them.
I'm sure they will, Joe. Now, did we get your bio right there? You basically teach people how to avoid misunderstandings between cultures, or could you give us in your own words?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I teach classes, I train organizations, I coach individuals, and basically it's been stimulated by a long career in international educational exchange, which began originally in the Peace Corps And why I think it's so important now is because the forces of globalization are thrusting people together at such a fast rate that there is what I call the convergence without context.
Mm-hmm.
People are thrust together without understanding who is it that I'm speaking to.
Right. Now, I understand you got started in what you call your storytelling journey across cultures when you first went to Africa. And from your book, I see your experiences there inspired a lot of your writing. So let's hear some of your stories from Africa.
Well, I think the first and most dramatic story that set me on this journey was when I was a Peace Corps volunteer traveling to Kenya, which I knew very little about. And I remember distinctly on the way to Nairobi getting out for a fueling stop in Entebbe, Uganda, middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I remember getting out of the plane, and the night was dark, and the air was humid, and it was warm. And I remember turning to a fellow volunteer and saying, "Wow, don't you smell the lions?"
Hmm.
Well, there were no lions, I later discovered, within 30 miles of that airport. And why did my senses begin to sense that I was smelling lions? And this was because at that time, and still sadly today, most of the images we get about Africa are about animals, safaris, sometimes, of course, poverty, AIDS, etc., etc. We rarely hear in the news any positive stories. So the fact that I felt that I was smelling lions was unconsciously influenced by all of these negative images about Africa and an absence of positive stories about people themselves.
Hmm.
So one of the great person-to-person discoveries I made, and it was difficult because when you get beyond your bubble, it's sometimes difficult and shocking. And in those days in the Peace Corps, we were given Swahili lessons 5 hours a day, no English. And at the end of one of the lessons, I remember my Swahili teacher came up to me, started chatting with me, and he held my hand for 20 minutes.
Hmm.
Now, full disclosure for your audience, I happen to be of heterosexual background, and I found this disconcerting. I was uncomfortable. But in those days, if you protested, if you showed any kind of impolite behavior, you could be deselected from the Peace Corps. What I didn't realize at the time, and I kept holding his hand, even though my hand was sweating, what I didn't realize at the time, that hand-holding between men is very common. Probably 90%, if not more, of Africa, men hold hands regularly. They walk down the street together holding hands.
Huh.
It has absolutely nothing to do with homosexuality.
Yeah.
In fact, later on I discovered that this is a common practice in parts of the Middle East, even in parts of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So what I began to learn from this was, oh my goodness, everything from taste to touch to words can have a different meaning across cultures. And the climax to this story came back later on when I told a Nigerian friend of mine here in San Francisco this story, and he laughed uproariously. And he said to me, "You know, when I first came to San Francisco, Joe, I was with a Nigerian friend, and we wanted to explore the Castro, which for your listeners may not know is the gay district of San Francisco." And they were walking through the Castro, holding hand in hand, as they would normally do in Nigeria, and they couldn't understand why so many people were inviting them into bars and hitting on them. So it was the reverse, the total reverse.
Hmm.
And I don't know, do I have a time to talk of one or two little more stories about my experiences in Kenya?
Yeah, let's hear a little more about Africa, sure.
Okay, so I was a teacher there, and I was a teacher in a rural school, and most of the students had never been to Nairobi, which is a big metropolitan town, city, and I took them to the University of Nairobi. They were all on a university track, and most of them had never been there before. And I introduced some of them to a professor there from Great Britain. She must have been in her early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my students went up to her and said, "Nice to meet you, Grandma." Now, for those people in your audience who happen to be in their elder years, however you may define that, it would be a great insult to be called grandma by a stranger.
Yes.
But the word grandma in many cultures is a term of great respect, which this professor was horrified to hear through her British lens.
Mm-hmm.
How dare this young whippersnapper call me grandma? But he meant the greatest of respect. And then finally, you know, to give you a little sense again of the interactions I had early on and what I misunderstood was when I arrived in my village, I assumed that my fellow Kenyan teachers would invite me to their homes. You know, as we would here, we would invite somebody who moved in the neighborhood. Never an invitation. And I had all kinds of ideas. Oh, maybe they don't want a white person to come to their house. Maybe they were angry about British colonialism. God knows, all kinds of fantasies. And finally, I invited them to my house. We had a lovely evening, and what would your expectation be, Paul? If they had a lovely evening at my house, what would you think they would do next?
I would think they would thank you.
Thank me and?
Invite you
to their house.
Exactly, and they never did. So this kind of, you know, rankled me. And so finally, a month or two later, I met them in a bar, and after a couple of drinks, I finally got up the courage to say to them, you know, did you have a good time when you were at my house a couple of weeks ago? Oh, Joe, it was a great evening. We learned a lot about the United States, and it was a pleasure to tell you more about Kenya. And then I said, you know, with trepidation, I said, well, can you tell me why you never invited me to your house? And the answer was, but we don't invite people because the door is always open. And so, indeed, I tested that out, and every single time I visited a Kenyan friend or colleague, whatever time of the day, I was invited in, and people started cooking and preparing meals.
Wow.
So an invitation in that context was totally gratuitous.
Right. Now, when you're telling your story, Joe, about the colleague who was holding your hand for half an hour, I couldn't help thinking that, you know, I've got a lot of really close male friends, like guys I would kill for, guys I would die for. But I can't, just the way the culture we've been brought up, and I couldn't imagine walking down the street holding one of these guys' hand, because even though I, you know, they're the best of friends, it's just not in our agenda here.
Right. It's not in your culture. So, indeed, you can believe that after 3 years, I got used to holding men's hands.
Ah.
Right? Because I learned a different pattern, I realized it didn't have the same association. So when I came back to the United States, as many people know, when you live in another country and you come back to your own country, you have reverse culture shock. Paul,
yep.
I didn't know what to do with my hand when I came back to the United States. It's not a question. What's normal in one society may be completely abnormal in another society. It's not objectively correct or incorrect. It's appropriate to each society.
Exactly.
But what's important is to understand what is the intent behind this behavior that I am finding so difficult to digest.
You know, it's interesting. Your story is bringing me back to when I was working down in Guatemala, and I moved down there, and you know, the Guatemalans are lovely people. And everybody hugs, you know, una brosa. I mean, it's everybody gets men, women, everybody hugs everybody. And it took me a while to get used to hugging. But being there for 3 years, I got hugging was what I did. And then I came back to the U.S. or I would travel to Bangkok or to Europe. And I was starting to go to hug people and realizing, okay, wait a second. This is going to be a problem here. I need to do different.
That's a big difference in cultures is personal space. I know some countries you just don't invade somebody within about 3 feet, and others you're just right up in there, right up on them. Okay, Joe, now your next set of stories you call Stories from the First Large-Scale Attempt to Integrate the Human Race Since the Tower of Babel. Well, that's quite a heavy statement there, Joel. So before you get to these stories, could you briefly clarify that statement?
Well, as you said in the intro, I worked for many years at an institution called International House at the University of California, Berkeley. And at International House, you have close to 575 students from 80 countries and 25 U.S. states who are studying at Berkeley, but they are living together, doing activities together, discovering each other, having culture shock, having cultural discovery. So here in a building that actually has a building that with people who speak often over 100 languages collectively, they have this opportunity to discover each other's humanity, although it may be difficult at times. And as a segue to my stories from Africa, to a couple of stories from the International House, let me tell you that when I came back from Kenya, I was walking in Central Park with a colleague, Central Park in New York City, and she said that she had taken her 3-year-old daughter to the park, and the daughter looked up in the sky, saw a bird, and said to her mother, "Mommy, where is that bird's cage?" Right? So why did the kid say that? Because the kid had only one sense of reality, their apartment where they had a parakeet in a cage. So her notion of a bird in a cage was the only possible notion she had. Where's the bird's cage? So come to International House. Now, this is a very recent story. You understand that there are all of these nationalities, all these religions, all of these people who look very different living together. And I have a relative who was living there, an American, and his roommate was from Spain, Barcelona. Paul, do you remember a year or two ago there was an ISIS bombing in Barcelona?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the second day, this Spanish student from Barcelona, who was my relative's roommate, looked out the window and pointed to these gentlemen out on the street with long beards and turbans and said, almost panic-stricken, to my relative, "Look, ISIS is on the street. ISIS." So he was locked into just that, like the little 3-year-old girl was locked into her only reality of a bird in a cage.
Right.
He thought anybody who had a turban would be associated with terrorism.
Yeah.
Who were these people? They were Sikhs. And for those in your audience who may not know, Sikhs originally come from India. There's over 500,000 in the United States. They don't practice Islam. They don't practice Judaism. They don't practice Christianity. They have their own religion. And the reason that they wear turbans is to protect their hair, which they're not supposed to cut because it's a gift from God. What were they doing on the street? They were giving out flyers to ask people to help the homeless. So this young gentleman from Spain was beginning to learn, gee, I have to get outside my bubble and begin to ask myself, what else could this mean? Right? Mm-hmm. In fact, Sikhs themselves do not refer to themselves as Sikhs in their language. Did you know that, Paul?
I don't think I did.
They call themselves Sikhs in their Punjabi language. So when they first came to the United States and they introduced themselves, they didn't want to call themselves Sikhs because people would think they were contagious, a total confusion about the use of language. So, you know, it's another example of a total misconception about these things. Now, in discussing this, preparing for this program, I was thinking, well, what about people who come to live at International House who historically may have had some difficulties across cultures? So I remember distinctly a woman from the Philippines. She was Christian. And she, as you may know, in the southern part of the Philippines, there's been some terrorism from a particular segment of the Muslim community. So she was working in our program office, and there was a Pakistani gentleman, a Muslim, who was working there too. Now, the whole point of International House is to foster mutual understanding. But this woman's experiences with any Muslim was so painful in her country that she would not even speak to this gentleman, wouldn't speak to him until, Paul, she got sick. And when she got sick, she couldn't go to the dining room because she would infect other people. Who was the person who brought her food? It happened to be this Pakistani gentleman. And in that process, she discovered, oh, my God, he's a human being, and I can't judge individuals based on a particular experience with a group, even a group within my own country that may not reflect groups in other countries, right? So this was a huge breakthrough for her. And I like to think of something famous that Mark Twain said about this. He said, when the cat sat on a hot stove, it never sat on a cold stove again.
Mm-hmm.
That the experience was so searing that it stopped it from having positive experiences with other people in general, right? I don't know if you want a couple other stories from International House, but just let me know if you have a little time for another one.
Well, Joe, let's get to these. You have some stories about everyday cultural differences.
Right.
Stuff we deal with every day, like hand gestures, table manners, even how we go to the toilet.
Right.
So
okay.
Share some of these narratives with us.
Okay. So, you know, in this country, thumbs up is usually a very good sign, right? It means thumbs up, good, great. You know, in some countries, parts of West Africa, parts of the Middle East, this is obscene. I spent some time in Ghana, and in Ghana I was doing some hitchhiking, and of course when you hitchhike, you know, in this country you often use your thumb to gesture to people. Nobody would pick me up. They thought I was insulting them. So that's a total, again, a gesture can have a totally different meaning across cultures. Or the okay sign, you know, the fingers like in the form of a circle, we mean okay. Mm-hmm. Well, in southern France, it means zero. In Japan, it means money. In Brazil, it can reference an orifice and be totally obscene.
Mm-hmm.
So again, one has to be careful of this. Or the victory sign, the V sign, right? This is very common in our culture. And actually, in Great Britain as well, the V sign is victory. You remember those images of Winston Churchill at
sure.
the end of the Second World War, right?
Sure.
But if you reverse the fingers and the two fingers are facing your audience, basically the back of the fingers, it means up yours. And Margaret Thatcher actually did that without thinking that there was going to be a different interpretation to the use of the victory sign. So it's a little bit about gestures. This goes on and on. There have been books about gestures across cultures. It's pretty striking. Eating. You know, many of us will, when we eat, we will have one hand under the table when we're eating, let's say, with a fork. And maybe many of us may have one hand under the table. Well, in France, I lived in France for 4 years. Generally speaking, it's polite to always have two hands under the table. And at the International House, many of the French students would see Americans with one hand under the table, and they would say jokingly, what are they doing with that hand?
Yeah.
Totally, totally misunderstood. Or slurping. So in Asia, when you have noodle soup, right, it's very common in Japan, in China, in parts of Korea, when you're having noodle soup, to make this sound. Okay? So if somebody that you didn't know did that next to you and who was eating with you and you'd never experienced that before, you might think that was rude. As a matter of fact, there was an American student at International House who told me he would no longer sit with Japanese students because he couldn't stand that sound, which happens to be a very positive sound in the context of eating noodles in that part of the world. So what he didn't realize is he was cutting off 80 million people in Japan because of that.
Mm-hmm.
3 months later, I saw him sitting with Japanese students and slurping himself.
Well, that's a fascinating example because I lived that for 10 months last year. We had a boy from Bangkok, Pooh, and Pooh was the best slurper in the world. And we would sit at dinner and... First of all, Pooh would eat voraciously. He'd have his bowl in front of him, and he would just dive in, and there was all this tremendous slurping noise, and the bowl was gone. And it was like Pooh never looked up. And my wife and I would be staring at one another, somewhat aghast, and we just chalked it up to that's how Pooh is. And I have to say that until you explained that to me just now... I've always thought that's just how Pooh is.
Well, did Pooh discontinue slurping, or maybe you you started slurping?
No, I did not start. I didn't start slurping, but Pooh was Pooh. I mean, you all met him when he was.
Yeah.
He's a character.
That's great.
Yeah. But it's true. I mean, that's a really good example of we really don't understand the things that are done around us and the impact they have. I almost hit somebody in Guatemala when a policeman was signaling me to stop. And, you know, stop when you put your hand up, palm forward, doesn't mean stop in Guatemala. That means come on. And if you have your hand the other way, and it was one of these where I wasn't doing what he wanted me to do, and he was getting very, very frustrated with me.
Well, Joe, this doesn't fit this sub-theme totally, but I remember you had a story in your book about American soldiers in Iraq that were using the wrong hand signal and it became deadly.
Yeah, this was a pretty, tragic misunderstanding. You know, some of these are amusing and then you get behind it, you know, you get beyond them and you practice and you adapt and you can become, you know, ambidextrous culturally. But in Iraq, there were, as you may recall, when the U.S. soldiers were in Iraq, they would often have these checkpoints where they wanted to check Iraqi cars to see if there was there were guns in the trunk, right?
Right.
So they would put their hands up, and meaning to say stop, right? So for the first time, for Iraqis who were not used to that gesture, because from their point of view, they thought the Americans were saying hello. Putting the hand up, hello. And there were several incidents where they just drove through the checkpoint and ignored the stop signal. And the Americans who didn't realize this cultural disconnect actually shot at some of the cars, and a few cases were killed. Some of the Iraqis were killed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, here's a more dramatic example of, and these things, unfortunately, happen across cultures too often. Even in Afghanistan, there have been many stories about U.S. soldiers who innocently would be sitting on the ground after a long day and have their feet sticking out, pointing outwards, not realizing that in many parts of Asia, the shoe is considered the dirtiest object, right? Mm. And so people would get furious, that feeling that they were being insulted by having somebody pointing a shoe at them. You remember, I think that there was a case when George Bush was in Iraq. You remember that? And somebody, and a journalist threw a shoe at him?
Right.
Yep. And what they didn't realize was he was not only angry because of a difference in policy, but it was the ultimate insult, because a shoe is always stepping on dirt. This is why in many countries people will take their shoes off before going into the house. Why would I want to bring my dirt into the house?
Right. Okay. Any other stories you have about just everyday things? I remember something in your book about toilets.
Oh, toilets. This is footprints. One of my favorites. The fact of the matter, Paul, is, I mean, it took me a long time to realize this, but, you know, you and I probably were raised in a culture where, you know, it was normal to be raised to sit on a toilet seat. The vast majority of people in the world, and I mean the vast majority of people in the world, do not sit on toilet seats. They crouch. They crouch. So what's the significance of that? They crouch because there's a hole in the ground, and they crouch, right? And the significance of that is when people who are used to that come to countries where it's expected that you would sit on a toilet seat, people would think, why would I want to sit where somebody else has sat? It must be dirty.
Mm-hmm.
So often they would get up on the seat with their feet on the seat, right, and be, in effect, crouch on the toilet seat. That is why there have been stories at international airports, certainly at surface. I've seen newspaper articles about San Francisco Airport where toilet seats have been broken. Jackson Hole, recently, just last year, there was a huge group of Chinese tourists who came, many of whom were not used to sitting on toilet seats, and there were a whole series of broken toilet seats. Myself, at International House, a janitorial gentleman came in to me one day and said, you know, I saw the damnedest thing in our restrooms today. I looked on, you know, one of the doors to one of the restrooms was closed, the other one is open. So our assumption is the door is closed and you can't see the feet under the doors. Your assumption often is there's something wrong with the toilet. It's broken. So as a maintenance person, he got up on the in the other stall to look over, and there he saw a student in the crouch position with his feet on the toilet seat, right? And he said to the student, we can laugh about it now, but it was very embarrassing at the time, sit down, relax, you're in America.
Yeah, I remember I was in Turkey once, and they had that everywhere, just a hole in the ground, and that's how you had to do it.
Yep, squat toilets are the way most of the world.
You probably squatted on a few, huh, Paul?
Yep, in Cambodia, picking up my daughter.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the lesson from this, and I'll just kind of close on this, is that I have learned, now as I get a little bit older, that if you have regularity issues, right, if you have constipation issues, doctors will tell you that the healthiest way to deal with that is to crouch. And that is why one of the most popular new items that you can get nowadays is something called the squatty potty. That permits you to sit on the toilet, but to simulate a position where you're actually squatting by lifting your knees up. So if anybody in your audience is having, try it.
Okay. I might get one myself. Okay. Well, this is Eric Heen and Paul Topikian, and you are listening to our guest storyteller, Joe Lurie, on So What's Your Story? Only on Pacifica KPFT 90.1 Houston and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville.
Now, Justin, what do you think? You've been behind the dials and listening for half an hour.
I enjoyed all the stories. I never knew that hand gestures could have more than one meaning. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, they can have way more than one meaning.
Gotta be careful.
They can have multiple meanings. So I hear there's some other storytelling activities that are brewing around here in Houston. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about them?
Sure. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it is a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. Their first swap of 2020 will be January 28th, and be sure to bring a friend. Be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all of their upcoming events. And while you're on the Guild's page, why not become a member? It's easy to do online. Also, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008. All listed on the menu under Radio Program. Don't own a radio? No problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook. We're also on YouTube. We're all over the place. We'd also like you to suggest program ideas when visiting So What's Your Story Facebook page, and be sure to share it with friends. And we'd love it if you'd like us when you leave. Got guests to suggest? Maybe yourself? Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. Don't forget our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy terrific stories. Next one is January 14th, and the theme is adventures. And for our listeners who want to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? Both happen to be staunch supporters of our program.
Justin, thanks. I understand there's some Houston storytellers, including Dr. Hank and Harwood Taylor, Chris Gorman, and others who will be telling stories at Wimberley's first storytelling festival on Saturday, February 22nd. And I think you have a little jingle to go with it. Can you cue that up for us?
Yes.
Well, I guess we missed that. But thank you, Justin, for filling us in the storytelling world around Houston. Next week, stay tuned. We have a long-distance guest whose intimate style will make you feel like he's seated right next to you, because backed by popular demand, we'll have Joel Barryizzi. Joel will tell stories about the healing power of laughter and will bring a smile to your face and a beam of light to your new year. Again, you'll only enjoy it here on So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 Houston.
Yeah, Joel Barryizzi, he was with us a couple weeks ago, and you're not going to want to miss that program. Next week, 8 p.m. on Thursday. So, thanks, Paul. Hey, Dr. Hank, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, thank you. This is a great show. Love talking about cultural differences. Love it. 1988, I'm teaching a class in intercultural communication, and I'm waiting to go down to class, and there's a student lost, and he comes to my office, and he says, I'm looking for the guy who's teaching the intercultural class. I said, that's me. He said, it can't be you. I said, well, what do you mean it can't be me? It is me. I promise it's me. You could even walk down to class with me. I have a key to the door and everything. He says, I'm looking for some guy. I mean, I how come you're not black wearing a dashiki? Because that's exactly what he wore. He thought that a person teaching intercultural had to look a certain way. Yeah. So this is really a great program because this is the most diverse city in the country. A lot of people don't know that, but it is. So the idea of thinking about cultural differences is so important. But, you know, if I could just kind of take off, I mean, have I got a couple of minutes here to tell you just a real quick story?
You sure do.
I thank you very much. Sure. I'm the producer. Why not? Right. And by the way, that Wimberley jingle, if you guys get it, let us know because it is a riot. You know, sometimes, as Joe was saying, we have so many examples of intercultural communication, but we sometimes forget that one of the biggest problems are intracultural communication barriers, problems within our own cultures, whether they be racial or sexual, artifactual, ideological, demographic. And as you guys know, when I worked with HPD for so many years, one of the biggest issues was dealing with cultural differences that police officers had to address every day in order to circumvent conflict, really stay safe. And there are a lot of examples that I can think of, but one that I love talking about was a young officer, 22 years old, who was going out to a scene to interview an elderly gentleman who was a witness of a series of serial burglaries. And the sergeant knew me at the time, and he wanted me to drive out with this officer because all he said to me was, this officer is not a great interviewer. So I want you to watch him, I want you to listen to him, and let me know what you think. Well, I didn't know what the sergeant meant, so I went with this officer out to a scene. He was in the Heights, and we're sitting on a front porch, and this gentleman is just salt of the earth. He tells us he's 90 years old, he's African-American, tells us he's from Macon, Georgia. He moved to Houston to be with his grandchildren and his granddaughter and his daughter, excuse me. And he's just the nicest person in the world. Now, during the next 45 minutes, he's not looking at the officer at all. The officer is asking all the right questions about what he witnessed. I'm there. And the gentleman is looking at me, but not really much more than he is looking at this young officer with a uniform. So 45 minutes later, we leave, we thank the gentleman, and the officer turns to me and says, you know, that SOB is lying to us. And I said, how can you possibly say that? This person was totally upfront and above board. He was terribly consistent. He was as gentle, as honest as they come. How can you say that? Well, because he wasn't looking at me. And I told him, first of all, eye contact in and of itself is an isolated variable. It's an isolated behavior. You can't look at one behavior and draw a conclusion. I'm sure Joe can substantiate that. You have to look at a context, right? So I asked the officer, what do you know about him? And he says, what do you mean? Well, what you know about him is that he's 90 years old. You can see that he's African American. He's from Macon, Georgia. And what does that tell you? And the officer simply didn't know. And I told him that you have to have knowledge in order to be tolerant. So you have to realize that when this gentleman was middle-aged, it was during the Civil Rights Movement, and in Macon, Georgia, if you looked at an officer, you were beaten up and sent to jail. And he was terrified of doing that. It had nothing to do with his sense of honesty, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, the officer said, well, I wasn't around there, so how was I supposed to know? Mm-hmm. I told him, well, you know, I wasn't around during the Civil War, but I've heard of Gettysburg. You know, the notion is that when we think about these cultural differences, one of the things that always disturbs me is that having knowledge is one thing, but you want to apply the knowledge and demonstrate a sense of tolerance. It's all about tolerance, you know. Mm-hmm. To me, tolerance is a verb. So I appreciate an opportunity to share that experience. It doesn't sound very profound, but there were many of them. And they all really addressed the issue of culture, whether or not these officers were dealing with prostitutes, the elderly, Asian, Orthodox Jews, drug dealers. It didn't make any difference. There were certain patterns of behaviors that you had to be able to understand in order to infiltrate, feel comfortable, feel safe, and interact effectively.
You know, do the police have special training, cultural training for that?
Nearly as much as you might think.
Yeah.
Really, not nearly as much as you might think. The ones that have the best training, I think, are undercover officers. Uh-huh. They have pretty good training, but them and the people who work vice, they have some. But if it's 8 hours, 10 hours at the most, that would be good.
Yeah. Well, you could, I think, write a book on your police experiences. I've heard quite a few of your police stories. That's great. Now, Joe, let's get back to your stories. I understand that you have some narratives about culture clashes that have been in the news lately. Could you, let's hear some of those.
Okay. But I can't resist, just very briefly, about the eye contact. I thought that was fascinating what was said there, because obviously it was important to look at the particular context of the story. But it is also a fact that many cultures, the avoidance of eye contact is a sign of respect. That particularly in Asian and many African cultures, not all but many, a young person should not be looking in the eyes of a person in authority or who is older. It is a sign of disrespect.
Yes.
And in fact, when I experienced this in Kenya, some of the people who were not sensitive to this accused the African students of being devious. And that narrative, unfortunately, spread across the continent.
That is a great point. It is a great point, Joe. I appreciate that, because I was with an officer once who literally smacked a young African-American male because he wasn't looking at him. But he was always taught that you don't look at an officer because if you do, that shows disrespect. So I'm so glad you mentioned that. If we could take 30 seconds and play this Wimberley jingle, people will love this. They're going to find out how nuts we are. And I think that's really, really important for this show because none of us are really normal. Joe, I'm sure, is getting this idea. But the level of abnormally has to really be reinforced here. So if you guys could play that jingle and make a fool out of us, I'd appreciate it.
Wimberley's First Storytelling Fest invites you to come, listen, laugh, and learn. Look at us. We're bringing storytellers in from all over Texas. Houston, Austin, San Antonio, and the Hill Country, too. Famous tellers, award-winning PBSers, indigenous elders, and local jawboners. We'll see you at 7A Ranch Opera House on 2/22/2020.
2/22/2020. The Storytelling Festival in beautiful Wimberley.
Yeehaw! Local, yeehaw!
Local jawboners. Got to see that. Okay, Joe, sorry about that interruption. We just had to get that in.
No, I loved it.
Okay, now let's get back to your culture clashes in the news. You got stories on that.
Well, you know, one of my favorite ones, this happened a couple of years ago, but it's still relevant, particularly when you start, hopefully we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about clashes with immigrants. But this is a story that was in the news in this country, in Scandinavia, in India, and it basically was about an Indian immigrant couple in Norway. And the Norwegian social service agency got wind of the fact that the Indian couple was sleeping with its three-year-old child in the same bed and that it was feeding the child with its fingers. Now, from the Norwegian social agency, that particular agency, I'm not at all saying all Norwegians would interpret it this way, but from their perspective, sleeping in the same bed with a three-year-old child was inappropriate. It could cause the child damage. It could even imply sexual abuse. And the fact that they were feeding the child with their fingers made it seem that these people are not healthy, this is uncivilized, and they took the child away from the parents, the social service agency. This was blown up into a huge diplomatic incident. And people can read more about this if they just kind of Google Norway, Indian children in the bed, etc. So the ambassadors got involved with this, and the child was taken away, and eventually they resolved this after a year or so, and the child was returned to India to stay with an uncle. So the social service agency stuck to its guns and basically said, we can't bring this child back there. So what they didn't realize is, once again, the vast majority of people in the world will sleep with their children in the same bed. In the same bed. Whereas most people in America, many parts of Europe, when a child is born, sure, they'll cuddle up with their parents, but frequently for the sleep, they'll put it in a cradle separate from the bed of the parents. Or nowadays, you even see in a separate room where you're watching the child on a monitor. So here was a case that had to be, that had gotten escalated up to the ambassadorial level and created tremendous ill feeling between India and Norway. And again, the whole question is it unhealthy to have your child sleep in the same bed with you? Your listeners may be shocked that in parts of Japan, sometimes children will sleep in the same bed as their parents up until the age of 12 or 13. And what that signifies is sometimes that the culture is so group-oriented that you are inculcated with that sense from the very beginning about sleeping with your parents in the same bed. Whereas we, for all of its pluses and minuses, are inculcated with a sense of individualism. You have to be separate. Learn to find your own way.
Right.
So that was a diplomatic incident. A different diplomatic incident happened a couple of years ago when the United States ambassador to China, who was an American of Chinese heritage, you may recall he was the governor of the state of Washington. And he, on his first arrival in China to take up his post as the United States ambassador to China, came with his wife and his kids, and he was not wearing a tie when he got off the plane. He was carrying his own luggage. His kids had knapsacks on their back. His wife was carrying a bag. Now, from our perspective, you know, take responsibility. Do things. You're traveling. What's the big deal? From a Chinese traditional perspective. I'm not saying all Chinese people are like this, but from the Chinese government's perspective, this showed a huge lack of disrespect. Come to the country representing the United States of America, and you are carrying your own baggage? You. And your wife is carrying a bag? And then you go to Starbucks and you order your own coffee? You didn't have some lackey do this for you? Now, secretly, some Chinese people probably enjoyed this, but from a Chinese authoritarian point of view, this was undermining, the image was undermining to their own strict control of their population. So that was, you know, a very powerful incident. And then taking again the sense of being casual, Bill Gates, right, a very intelligent man, brilliant man, he goes to Korea and actually several other countries, and he greets the then president of South Korea, who was a woman at the time. This is just 2 or 3 years ago. And he has his left hand in his pocket. He doesn't learn to bow, and he shakes the hand of the president with his left hand, no tie, left hand in his pocket. Hmm. This picture was broadcast throughout South Korea, and it was seen as the greatest insult, not just to the president, but to the entire nation of South Korea. Mm-hmm. You have insulted all of us with this kind of casual behavior. And in the same way, Barack Obama. Now, we all know he had a smoking problem, right? Mm-hmm. And he battled it throughout his presidency. So how one of the ways that he battled it was to chew Nicorette. He was trying to get off this bad habit. So he was so intent on getting off the habit, he forgot that when he was greeting the Queen of England, he was chewing Nicorette, and people thought he was chewing gum. Mm. And they thought he was being so casual, and this was he was called a boor, a shocking boor, an uneducated person. Same thing happened in China.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure he got feedback about it later, and hopefully he corrected that. I didn't see him do this with other leaders, but it created a huge issue in the press.
Wow, okay. Now, Joe, we've done several programs here about refugees and immigrants.
Yeah.
And I know you have stories about cultural snafus involving immigrants. Let's hear those.
Right. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time mentoring immigrants and refugees when they come to this country to help them find work. And many of them are highly skilled that I've met over time. And when they go to a job interview, I found that not only do they avoid eye contact for the reasons we spoke of earlier, but often when they shake hands with the people who are interviewing them, it's a very gentle handshake. We might refer to it as a fish shake in this country, right? A fish, you know, kind of fishy. It's not, we believe in firm handshakes,
yes,
engagement, right? So many people who come from these more group-oriented societies where you're not supposed to stand out will give a very gentle handshake. Hmm. I remember the first time I went to Thailand, for example, I would give the firm American handshake, and they thought I was being very aggressive. Mm. So this could be misinterpreted in a job interview, obviously. And in an American job interview, it's very common to get a question like, tell me about your accomplishments. Well, many of these immigrants and refugees will start off answering by saying, we. Not I. And I, in my coaching sessions, would say, well, try saying I. We want to know what you did. Mm. And the answer frequently was, but I couldn't have done it without other people. It was just stunning to me. Yeah. But from an American interviewer's point of view, many of them, they would say, this person doesn't have self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
This person is not willing to talk about and talk about his or her accomplishments. I remember, this is an extraordinary story. I was coaching a woman from Nepal who had been a television anchor in Nepal, right? And she came here, and her resume did not show, you know how we like to show accomplishments at the bottom of the resume?
Yes.
She didn't have any accomplishments or distinctions, even though she had a high-powered job there. So I asked her, well, do you have any special distinctions? Do you get any honors? And she looked very uncomfortable, which told me, after many years of training, that there were, but she didn't want to talk about it because it would be like bragging. Finally, you know what I discovered?
Mm-hmm.
That she got the only award from the King of Nepal for distinguished service to the country. It had never been given before.
Mm-hmm.
That she was selected to escort Hillary Clinton around the country. Of course, if you wrote that on your resume, people would want to interview just to find out what Hillary Clinton was like.
Oh yeah.
That she was the translator for Colin Powell when he was in Nepal, for Colin Powell and the King of Nepal. All of this if it had been on her resume, would have given her a certain cachet that would have gotten her a little further or more likely to have gotten interviews. And then there was this Filipino gentleman. I asked him, you know, what is your profession? And, you know, his answer was, I'm just a doctor. Just a doctor. And it turned out, when I finally got to know him better, that he was the head of the most important surgery clinic in the Philippines. So yeah. For him to point out that, you know, he had these accomplishments, you know, the Japanese have a great proverb about this. When the nail sticks out, hammer it down. Do not point to yourself. It is antithetical to group-oriented societies. And then one or two other extraordinary experiences that I have had with refugees and immigrants is, you know, when they come to this country, any country, one of the first things they need is health assistance, right?
Right.
And if they've gone through, let's say, physical trauma, if they've been tortured, you know, many of us would say, well, let them see a therapist, talk therapy. You know, I'm from New York City. And if you weren't seeing a therapist in New York City, they thought you were crazy, right? It was a completely different thing that we're brought up with. If you talk about it, you're going to feel better. You're going to get rid of all of your demons.
Right.
Well, you know, in many of these countries, to tell people about your most private things to a stranger is insane, totally insane. So also, if they go into a hospital room and they're sitting alone waiting for a doctor, I'm sure many of your listeners have been in hospital rooms waiting for a doctor to come in, and you've never seen a stethoscope or a blood pressure cuff, you might think they're people who thought that these were instruments of torture because it reminded them of these traumas.
Right.
And then on the health side, you know, different countries have different approaches to how you diagnose and cure various diseases. So on the health side, many countries in Asia, if you have a particular sickness, it's characterized as either cold or warm, right? So giving birth in parts of Asia is considered a cold state of the body. And the way, when this famous story of a woman who was giving birth in an American hospital from Vietnam, and they kept giving her cold water to keep her hydrated, right?
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't drink it. She needed warm water to balance the cold state of her body. So this was another example of a tragic disconnect in the health setting, of which there are many. You know, unfortunately, we could do a whole program just on health across cultures because it's really important to be able to heal, to help people to understand different ways of curing people, of communicating with doctors.
Well, and that whole notion of deference and not, you know, not speaking about what it is that you need it's alien. And there are cultures where there is a need, but they're not going to express it. Similarly, if there's a conversation that's going to go to a place where there's conflict, they'll just avoid the conflict. I've had that happen in a number of situations where people in meetings would say yes, and I clearly knew they didn't mean yes, but I also knew they were not going to, I was the boss, and they were not going to challenge the boss in that situation, and we'd have to leave the meeting, and then I'd have to go back and ask, was that the yes that was yes, yes, or was that the yes, you really think this is stupid and you're not going to do it at all, or because, you know, it was important that it took years to figure it out, but to realize that in situations like that, asking a question was not going to really get me the answer I needed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a famous essay written by a Japanese businessman called 16 Ways to Avoid Saying No, which is understood in the context of the Japanese culture, but, you know, and it's very common in other parts of Asia, to say no is a confrontation.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, same in Thailand, and it's challenging when you don't recognize it at first.
Yeah. Well, Joe, I read in your book, you know, I saw one of the stories that we talked about before the show, and it was kind of my favorite. You know what's coming here.
I think it's coming. Watch it.
You have a story in your book about Rudy Giuliani, an African artist, and elephant dung.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty interesting combination. So we got to squeeze that story in here. Let's hear that story.
So let me squeeze. This is a true story. It was all over the press in New York City. And basically, this Nigerian artist, he's very well known in Europe and in West Africa, in Nigeria, where he's from originally. He is Catholic. You need to know that in the beginning. And he did this painting of the Madonna. First thing that struck people, and it was exhibited at the Brooklyn Museum in New York, a very distinguished museum, along with other paintings. First thing was that the Madonna was black. And I think you will see in general, people, when they project their images of God, they are projections of who, what they look like themselves. So that was the first thing that was a little bit unsettling for some people. But the thing that really knocked people out, including Mayor Giuliani at the time, was that there were images of, actually even pieces of, varnished elephant dung on one of the breasts of the black Madonna. The reaction in the community was shock, outrage. Giuliani himself said this was Catholic bashing without realizing that this gentleman was Catholic himself. And he threatened to withdraw $7 million of city grants to support the Brooklyn Museum. Now, perfectly understandable why people would be outraged by this, but what they didn't understand is that in many parts of Africa, not all, but some parts of Africa, elephant dung is a symbol of power and fertility. And that other paintings, now this is a black man, had paintings of Miles Davis, Diana Ross, James Brown with dung on them. And then nobody was accusing him of being anti-black. Now, in fairness, there should have been something next to the painting that explained that in parts of Africa, elephant dung is a sacred item because it produces fertility, so that people wouldn't have this knee-jerk reaction. And in the case of Giuliani, who went just berserk about this, you know, threatening to close down the exhibit, threatening to withdraw $7 million worth of funding for the museum, which is basically, you know, if to kind of close off my stories for the evening, just for the evening, is, you know, when you see something that is offensive or odd or threatening or whatever, pause and ask yourself before you take the leap that could get you into trouble, what else could this mean?
Exactly. No, I don't think I'll ever think of elephant dung the same way again, and I'll never think of Rudy Giuliani the same way. Okay,
no,
folks.
We may have confirmed some assumptions there.
Yes. Okay. Well, Joel, thanks for being on our show tonight. And now the stories you've been telling tonight, that's just the tip of the iceberg. You got a lot more similar stories in your book, Perception and Deception, which can be found at perceptionanddeception.com. So thanks for being our guest tonight, Joel. Really enjoyed your stories.
And thanks for having me. I enjoyed yours as well. I'd like to fly to Houston tonight and continue the conversation.
There you go. We'd welcome you with open arms. Well, okay, folks, don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on Tennyson's Tape Deck. Be sure to make 90.1 a part of your everyday life. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or dealing with elephant dung, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen and Paul Topekian, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Well, as we're able, put it all on the table. I think that this whole world, soon, mama, my whole wide world, soon, mama, my whole world, soon gonna be getting mixed up.
Sing it.
Soon, mama, my whole world, soon, mama, my whole wide world, soon, mama, my whole world, soon gonna be getting.
KPFT makes a difference with real people, real stories, and real voices.
I was put in a room where I was hung by my arms. I couldn't
sit down. I couldn't rest all the time with a bag over my head.
Whether it's hearing music that opens your mind or radio that stirs your soul. You know you can count on KPFT to bring you the stories and the people behind the stories.
The Shock Doctrine, what I'm calling the Shock Doctrine, is a philosophy of power. It's a doctrine of domination.
This is radio worth supporting, and you make a difference. Visit kpft.org to view our complete program schedule. Give feedback on our shows or pledge online. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio.